Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the desperate flurry of tweets from Trump over the weekend, which have led many to wonder whether the president is losing it, an observation made by the husband of Trump's close advisor, Kellyanne Conway, who thinks that the leader of the free world's chronic narcissism has reached a dangerous level of pathology. Norman Ornstein, a contributing editor for The Atlantic and the author of the bestsellers It's Even Worse Than It Looks, How the American Constitutional System Collided with the New Politics of Extremism, now in an updated version, It's Even Worse Than It Was. He joins us to discuss the possibility that the impending Mueller report is contributing to Trump's besieged mentality and exaggerated sense of grievance as he issues tweet storms against Saturday Night Live, Senator McCain, General Motors, and most of all, Robert Mueller. We'll look into Trump's not-so-veiled threat to call up his supporters in the military, the police, and bikers for Trump in his defense if things turn worse for him, and assess whether the country could be dangerously divided by Trump to save his skin, with his more fervent followers taking up arms and manning the barricades to defend their leader, no matter how damning the evidence against Trump is that Mueller presents. Then we'll speak with a specialist on the Chinese military and intelligence services, June Dreyer, a professor of political science at the University of Miami, who was the Asia advisor to the Chief of Naval Operations. She joins us to discuss the move by top Democrats on the Senate Intelligence and Judiciary Committees and the chairs of the House Judiciary and Intelligence Committees to demand the FBI investigate Cindy Yang, the former owner of a string of massage parlors in Florida, who was using her ties to Trump and Mar-a-Lago to gain influence for her and Chinese officials in the Trump administration in ways that appear to benefit Chinese intelligence. Then finally, we'll examine the New Zealand Prime Minister's promise of a swift tightening of that nation's gun laws following last Friday's massacre, which left 50 dead. Patrick Blanchfield, a journalist and faculty member at the Brooklyn Institute for Social Research, whose forthcoming book is Gun Power, The System of American Violence, joins us to compare New Zealand's response to the need for gun control with the inaction in the United States and how white nationalist terrorists are seen as deranged loners, whereas Muslims are painted with a broader cultural brush used to indict entire groups of people. And before we begin today's program, I want to thank listeners like you who are helping us build a new home online at backgroundbriefing.org. We encourage you to bookmark our new website and join the community of listeners we are building nationwide with your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep us independent and free from corporate sponsors so that we can continue to provide breaking news analysis from the most knowledgeable guests we can find as we build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And joining us now is Norman Ornstein, a contributing editor for The Atlantic, a contributing editor and columnist for The National Journal, and a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute for Public Policy Research. He's the author of numerous books, most recently the New York Times bestseller, It's Even Worse Than It Looks, How the American Constitutional System Collided with the New Politics of Extremism, co-authored with Thomas Mann, now in an updated version, It's Even Worse Than It Was. And he's the co-author of One Nation After Trump, A Guide for the Perplexed, the Disillusioned, the Desperate, and the Not Yet Deported. Welcome to Background Briefing, Norman Ornstein.
Great to be with you, Ian.
And I take it where you are, Norman, rumors are swirling, and a lot of people are making the comparison that Trump's tweets over the weekend were particularly furious, perhaps even unhinged, that he's spiraling out of control, and that his condition is getting worse. And, of course, in that I'm quoting the husband of his chief aide, Kellyanne Conway's husband. So what do you make of all of these rumors?
What I make of it is, I guess, two things. The first is this is a president whom we've known from the get-go was basically a narcissistic sociopath. And that hasn't changed. And so some of these tweets, including many of the particularly offensive ones surrounding the horrible tragedy in New Zealand, that were all about him. It was, and that included, of course, I'm sure at his urging, Kellyanne Conway saying that people should read the entire manifesto of this deranged murderer, something which responsible people have tried to keep from happening because we don't want to glorify him or his theories, so that we can prove that Donald Trump had nothing to do with it, his rhetoric or in any other way. This is about him. It's not about the tragedy of the people that died, much less that larger issue of white supremacy. So that's one thing. The second thing is we seem to get these tweet storms that are increasingly outrageous every time there is a suggestion that there might be more indictments or that the investigation is getting closer and closer to him. And that's not just Robert Mueller's investigation, but also the Southern District of New York and the work now being done by both the district attorney in New York and the attorney general of New York. The latter two, of course, looking into offenses potentially that would not be ones he could pardon himself for. And I think there's also at least a tiny suggestion now that we're seeing this prosecution of Jeffrey Epstein, the person who was engaging in human trafficking of a sort with underage girls, who was a friend of Trump's, that maybe there'll be something embarrassing there as well. That's all complete speculation on my part. But all of the things that are closing in on him, and he knows what's been done and what he's culpable for, are things that cause him to go off the rails and to try and change the subject. And clearly he did that with a whole host of things that he wrote and put on Twitter over the weekend.
And, of course, that included attacking John McCain. It included attacking General Motors and, of course, Mueller with increased intensity. And apropos Epstein, there is, of course, a somewhat tangential connection there with the Chinese woman that ran all the massage parlor at which Trump's friend was arrested, the billionaire owner of the New England Patriots.
So we know that this is a kleptocracy. Trump has taken advantage of being president to get a lot of money. He doubled the initiation fee at Mar-a-Lago. He goes into the dining room there and interacts with all the people who've been willing to pay $200,000 to just join the club and others who become guests. And we know that there's been a kind of pay for play. We know, for example, I'll get to the woman who owns the owned the spa that was basically using sex slaves almost. But we know that there were three people who were members of Mar-a-Lago with no experience in government, who had no role in government, who were making decisions for the Department of Veterans Affairs. We know that if you belong to Mar-a-Lago, you could get access to cabinet members and talk to the president about things you wanted to deal with or some of your own problems. And we know that this woman understood how the system worked. And she was taking fees from Chinese nationals, bringing them to Mar-a-Lago. In some cases, they didn't even speak any English, so that they could interact with the president and who knows what their aims were, and that she was using campaign contributions and apparently illegally harvesting money from her employees that she would sometimes reimburse them for, which is completely illegal under campaign finance laws, to send more bundles of money to the Trump campaign and to other Trump enterprises so that she could get more access. And we have, of course, photographic evidence, pictures of her with Trump viewing the Super Bowl, with major figures in both the Trump campaign and in the administration. We haven't seen anything like this before, and this is only the tip of the iceberg when it comes to the potential legal and other problems that he faces.
And, of course, later in the program, Norm Mornstein will be talking to a specialist on China who happens to live in Miami. And it turns out that Cindy Yang is the woman we're talking about, is the vice president of the chapter of a Chinese front group for Chinese intelligence. So there is another dimension, and that gets you to the point of asking, what is it that they have on Jared Kushner? Intelligence people do not ruin their careers butting heads with the President of the United States, their commander-in-chief. It had to be something awfully important for the intelligence community to put its foot down and refuse to give Jared Kushner a clearance, which, of course, they were overruled by the President, prompting the President's Chief of Staff, General Kelly, and the White House lawyer, Don McCann, to write for-the-record memos saying that they disapproved of the President's giving Jared Kushner a intelligence clearance. So what's going on there?
Well, I think we have two things here with Jared Kushner. First is the belief by the intelligence services and Kelly that Kushner was too easily swayed into doing things and maybe even making trades, including vital American security information, in return for getting financing for his family's properties, where they were overextended and underfinanced. The second is that if you have applied for a security clearance and you make one mistake on the forms you have to fill out about the foreign trips you've taken, about the contacts you have, that's usually enough to disqualify you. Kushner made dozens and dozens and dozens of errors of omission and commission, mostly omission, where he had to continually revise the forms. There is nobody else who's tried to get a security clearance who's had to go through or who's been able to go through that and still get that clearance. And we know many suspicious things that have flowed since Kushner has that clearance. We know that MBS, the crown prince in Saudi Arabia, the man who everybody with intelligence information believes was directly behind the brutal torture and slaying of the Washington Post journalist Khashoggi, has bragged to all kinds of people that he has Jared Kushner in his pocket. And we know that Kushner has met with prominent figures in Saudi Arabia and elsewhere in the Middle East and would not allow embassy personnel to be with him in those meetings, which is very strange, unusual, and suggests that things were going on there that were not necessarily done for the national interest of the United States. This is the sort of behavior that we see from autocrats and authoritarians everywhere. Family members and cronies take advantage of positions of access and influence in government to make money or to do things for their own interests and not for those of the nation they're sworn to represent. It's very troubling.
Well, on Thursday, the House voted 420-0, Norm Mornstein, to demand, or at least to urge the Attorney General William Barr to make sure that the Mueller report is put out in full to the public. The next day, Donald Trump tweeted that the special counsel should never have been appointed and there should be no Mueller report. This was an illegal and conflicted investigation in search of a crime. If you take that at face value, there's something going on behind the scenes here, I would suggest. You know, if the Congress is making a stand, and they've never agreed on anything, but 420-0, that's pretty impressive.
Yeah.
Something's going on. Do they have a whiff? Is there a sort of whiff of something about to drop like a huge...
You know, I think the vote in the House, which, of course, we would not have had at all if it weren't for the reality that the Democrats have the majority and can bring up what they want. Republicans didn't want to be, I think, on the side of saying that we shouldn't know what was in that report. That's one part of it. But they also knew that the Senate wasn't going to act and that it had no force of law. And, of course, there's another figure we can talk about who is at least as suspicious as Jared Kushner, and that's Lindsey Graham, who not only did not condemn Donald Trump for viciously attacking Graham's longtime dear friend and mentor, John McCain, but but single-handedly blocked that resolution calling for the full release of the Mueller report from coming up for a vote in the Senate. So we've got that. We know that Mueller, all of these predictions that the report would be issued in a few days and then in a week and then in the next week, and we have not seen it. But what we do know now is that Mueller has extended a grand jury, has suggested that Carter Page, one of the major figures involved with the Russia investigation, is cooperating in more areas. And it may be some time before we get a full or final report from Mueller. We also know that the Southern District of New York is investigating Trump Enterprises. And while it's not clear they would be able to bring a RICO case, the racketeering and organized crime statute, that if they prove that this was a criminal organization, and there are all kinds of suggestions of money laundering, of bad behavior, they could confiscate the assets. There are things going on there that are leaving the Trump people nervous, and Trump always goes on the offensive when things like that emerge. One of the more outrageous tweets was basically saying that the Democrats tried to steal the election from him. And of course, he condemned John McCain, saying that he tried to sway the election by turning over the dossier, when in fact the dossier had been out there. McCain got it after the election and gave it to the FBI, saying the first thing we have to take care of is our country. So McCain was a hero. Trump has lied about his role and has lied repeatedly about what the Democrats did and what Mueller has been doing. And it's sad that we now are in a society where there seem to be no consequences for those lies.
So given that a poll just came out saying 71% of the country are happy with the economy, in other words, 7 out of 10 say the economy is in good shape. Yeah. And if you go back to Carville's or Begala's famous adage, it's the economy, stupid. Does that therefore mean, Norm Ornstein, that the Mueller report has to be sufficiently explosive to break that spell? Are people that disengaged from the extraordinary issues that you and I are talking about, but frankly, they're not necessarily resonating across the country?
So we know that good economic performance can make a real difference in a presidential election. We also know that given where the economy is and the public's satisfaction with it, his approval rating ought to be way upwards of 50%, and it's hovering down around 40%. We also know that the economy today may not mean a whole lot when it comes to a presidential election that is quite a ways away, and that there are lots of reasons to be uneasy, that we're on a kind of sugar high from the tax cuts. But with the trade issues, with some of the other fundamentals in place, we'll hit a downturn at some point. It could happen before the election. What I would say as a general matter, though, is that given the nature of the Electoral College and the places where Trump's votes are concentrated, given that we really don't know what will happen in the Democratic nominating process, what we know is that Trump could lose the popular vote by 7, 8, or 9 million, and you could easily weave a scenario where he still wins the Electoral College and wins a second term, assuming, of course, that he is still president and is running for re-election. And there's another area where we're really at a loss and have no clue where we'll be.
Well, if he loses, according to Michael Cohen's testimony before the Congress, he may not want to leave office. And we know from a recent remark he made to Breitbart, he made some not-so-veiled threats where he said that I have the military, the police, and bikers for Trump on my side, and we can get tough. You know, the liberals are tougher than we are, but we can get tough. I don't think there's any other way to interpret that but a threat. So that is unbelievable, and I cannot believe that there hasn't been more outrage. How did you interpret it?
So when I saw that statement, I did a tweet on it saying this was the big story and that it was not being portrayed that way. We have become so inured, at least our mainstream media have, to outrageous things that Trump says or tweets, that they tend to be disregarded. And that is, I think, a horrible mistake. that particular tweet is the stuff of authoritarians. And those kinds of threats, even if, you know, I got a lot of responses, tens of thousands of people responded to that tweet, but in a series that I did on it. But some of them were, well, look, the military, they aren't going to do what he wants. And the police, they're more responsible than that. And my response to that is, one, that may be true of most in the military and most in the police. It won't necessarily be true of all. Two, the bikers for Trump part of it is in some ways the far more chilling part, because we know there are a lot of people out there who will grab their guns and go to the barricades if Trump tells them to. And I've said for some time that my worst case scenario, it isn't a certainty. It may not even be better than even possibility, but it's not a zero possibility, is that when these investigations get close enough to him that they really threaten his own freedom and his money, that he will go on Fox or Twitter and basically say this is a coup attempt. The deep state and Hillary Clinton are trying to steal the election I won fair and square, take to the streets to protect our country. And then we're going to get some confrontations and we're going to get some bloodshed. And then that's why this state of emergency that will likely survive the veto becomes more significant. He could declare a state of national emergency, and there are powers there where he could suspend civil liberties and take over the telecommunications networks and do the kinds of things that are the stuff of novels or the stuff of places like Russia or Turkey.
Well, just in closing, Normantine, apropos Cindy Yang, who we were talking about earlier in Florida, the woman that ran all the massage parlors and who hung out at Mar-a-Lago, today four leading Democrats are demanding a new FBI investigation into her, Senator Mark Warner, Senator Feinstein, Adam Schiff, and Jerry Nadler. So there will be more to come on that. But your warning that you just gave us is pretty chilling, and it's hard to believe that we're even having this discussion, but we are.
Well, we need to be aware of this, Ian. Exactly. Even though, you know, I don't want to say the sky is falling, and it's possible that our institutions will hold and none of these things will happen, and we will go through a kind of orderly process, as ultimately we did, for example, with Richard Nixon. But we can't ignore the possibility that we're dealing with somebody here who does not have the values that most of us expect in a president.
Well, Normantine, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Sure. Lots of things to talk about and happy to do it.
Thank you, Norm. And again, I've been speaking with Normantine. He's a contributing editor to The Atlantic, a contributing editor and columnist for The National Journal, and a resident scholar at the American Enterprise Institute for Public Policy Research. He's the author of numerous books, most recently the New York Times bestseller, It's Even Worse Than It Looks, How the American Constitutional System Collided with the New Politics of Extremism, co-authored with Thomas Mann, now in an updated version, It's Even Worse Than It Was. And he's the co-author of One Nation After Trump, A Guide for the Perplexed, the Disillusioned, the Desperate, and the Not Yet Deported. Going to take a brief station break and back looking into the call by top Democratic officials for the FBI to investigate Cindy Yang, the former owner of a string of massage parlors in Florida, who was using her ties to Trump and Mar-a-Lago to gain influence that appears to benefit Chinese intelligence.
Place I long to be.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24-7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is June Dreyer, who's a professor of political science at the University of Miami, specializing in international relations, Asian-Pacific political and economic systems, Chinese government and foreign policy, and U.S. defense policy. She was the Asia advisor to the Chief of Naval Operations and is the author of China's Political System, Modernization, and Tradition. Welcome to Background Briefing, June Dreyer.
Thanks. Nice to be back.
Well, thank you. And you're there in Miami, and so you're not too far from the scene of the crime in terms of the massage parlors that the local sheriffs rolled up in a big operation that netted, of all people, the owner of the New England Patriots and the woman that owned these massage parlors, Cindy Yang. Now we're learning that she was involved with – she was actually the vice president of – CAST, C-A-S-T, the China Association for Science and Technology, which the intelligence community considers to be a front for Chinese intelligence. So the plot thickens. So what do you know about CAST, and what do you know about Cindy Yang?
Well, I must say, the existence of Cindy Yang was news to me. There is a Chinese community here, but it's not that large. And I understand that she was also an officer, perhaps even the president, of another organization called the Committee for the Reunification of the Taiwan with the Motherland, something like that. This is a very typical Chinese operation. They have something called United Front Tactics, and what they like to do is either place their own nationals in positions abroad and then nurture them, or they find people who are already here and work through them. Many of them will be American citizens, and they play on these people's patriotism. And I assume that most patriotism does not involve running massage parlors, but they make a great deal of money. And in return for providing the Chinese government with intelligence, they provide the person who helps them with good business contacts back in China. So it's kind of, you give us the information we want, you make the contacts we want you to make, and we make sure your business prospers.
Well, frankly, I understood that massage parlors actually do play a role in intelligence. The Russian intelligence services refer to them as a honey trap.
That's right.
So that may be an angle. And by the way, the organization that you refer to that she also belongs to, along with CAST, the China Association for Science and Technology, of which she was the Miami chapter's vice president, she was also a member of the Council for the Promotion of the Peaceful Reunification of China, which all sounds sort of mom and apple pie, does it not?
Not if you know what she's really talking about. No, it's much more sinister than that. Interestingly, we, the Western press, are playing the Chinese game here because reunification is a canard. And it's furthermore, it's not even in the Chinese. The re part is not in the Chinese. Taiwan has never been part of the People's Republic of China. It was a province of Manchu China, meaning the non-Han dynasty, for less than 10 years when the Japanese took it over. And it has been run autonomously, in other words, a separate country, ever since. And the idea here is to influence American policy toward not supporting the continuing independence of Taiwan, because they keep saying that it's part of China, which it isn't.
So what do you make then of the move today on the part of a number of leading Democrats, including Senator Mark Warner, the ranking member on the Senate Intelligence Committee, House Intelligence Chair Adam Schiff, Senator Dianne Feinstein, who's the ranking member on the Senate Judiciary Committee, and House Judiciary Committee Chairman Jerry Nadler. They're calling on the FBI to conduct a criminal and counterintelligence probe into allegations of human trafficking, foreign lobbying, and potential campaign violations against Cindy Yang, who we've been talking about, the founder of this chain of Florida massage parlors. And it does seem that they're possibly prompted by what we're talking about. Do you think that's what is going on here?
Well, I think it's all part of a much larger operation and something that the FBI has actually been looking at for years, the Chinese influence gathering and working through Chinese nationals who are active in other countries, in some cases actually planting them in the other countries. The way this fellow Yang Zhen in New Zealand, who neglected to mention on his immigration application that he was born and educated in China and worked for 10 years at a university teaching the People's Liberation Army intelligence techniques. And somehow he got naturalized in New Zealand and then got elected to parliament, and then got security clearances. And, of course, he alleges he never passed any classified information along to New Zealand, and almost nobody believes that. But this is the kind of thing they've been doing in Australia. The Australian Intelligence Operation, ASIO, it's the abbreviation, Australian Security and Intelligence Organization, arrested a member of parliament there as well. He was an Iranian immigrant, but he was doing espionage work for the Chinese.
And, of course, there have been scandals in Australia from wealthy Chinese real estate investors and moguls putting a lot of money into politics. And, again, the same defense is that I'm a successful businessman and I have no ties to the mainland. But my understanding is...
But in this case, that would be a demonstrably false argument, because the person that you're talking about, the most prominent one, is named Huang Shangmo. And he has extensive business dealings in China.
And again, I'm speaking with June Dreyer, who's a professor of political science at the University of Miami, specializing in international relations, Asian-Pacific political and economic systems, Chinese government and foreign policy, and U.S. defense policy. And she was an Asia advisor to the chief of naval operations and is the author of China's Political System Modernization and Tradition. But when we talk about New Zealand, of course, obviously there's a lot of focus on New Zealand at the moment because of the hideous massacre in Christchurch. But my understanding is that China is being very active in the Asia-Pacific region, in Vanuatu, for example, wanting to sort of – it's called a debt trap. They did the same thing in Sri Lanka, where you invest in infrastructure projects, and then when the local government – can't pay you back, you then say, well, now that I built your port, give us a 99-year lease on it. There's some concern that that's going to be happening all across the Asia-Pacific regions with these small Pacific Island nations that are fairly impoverished and might well be open to bribes.
Oh, their governments are extremely open to bribes. And I believe that it's Tonga that has already fallen into the debt trap. And then Niue has also granted port rights to Chinese ships. And this is thought to be part of something called the String of Pearls, in that they want to set up naval ports of call in various places around the world. And as you noted, they have already succeeded in doing that in Hambantota on the edge of the Indian Ocean there, and that naturally makes the Indian government rather nervous, since they understandably think of the Indian Ocean as their back door, so to speak. And I know that the Chinese government was heavily backing a candidate for re-election in the Maldives, and that the Indian government then managed to funnel a great deal of money to his opponent, who won. And again, that was an effort to stem the Chinese influence in that strategic area. So it's happening all over the place. In Greece, the port of Piraeus is now now owned and managed by a Chinese company. And the, of course, as you know, the Greece was one of the poor four in the EU, and it managed its finances very badly. And the EU was hesitant about bailing it out too often, and the Chinese said, "Here, we have money." And that's how it happens.
So, and of course, there are questions about what's going on in the Philippines with that rather murderous leader they have there. Duterte, who seems to be both dangerous and corrupt. And he has sort of sold out the Philippines' interests in the South China Sea. He's basically given up sovereignty on islands that are very close to the Philippines. So is he being bribed, do you think, by China?
Oh, it's so hard to say because he is so quirky that you can't tell what he's going to say or do from one day to the other. And he may be saying that we just don't think we can count on the United States, so we better bandwagon with China and better surrender some islands than sacrifice more.
So back to Florida, where you are, June Dreyer.
I have the feeling that I'm being personally held responsible for Cindy Yang. Yes, back to Cindy Yang.
Back to Cindy, yes, and whatever it's called, the Golden Orchid or whatever, or chain of massage parlors. The underlying story, though, is not at all amusing. It is absolutely scandalous and scurrilous to think of these poor Chinese women who are conned by local gangsters into coming over here thinking that they're going to have good jobs and earn enough money to pay off their debts to their smugglers. And then they find themselves literally indentured to massage parlors, rat-infested, horrible places, apparently, where there are no beds and facilities. They actually have to sleep on the very tables that they perform sex acts on, you know, hundreds of times a week, I don't know how many times a day, just the worst possible conditions, and making this woman so rich that she can become a member of Donald Trump's Mar-a-Lago and then become a broker for other Chinese businessmen who want to have dealings with the White House. And presumably, again, that has dimensions if she is in some way a kind of cutout for Chinese intelligence.
Well, you may or may not recall, since you and I have been talking for several years now, that the same kind of thing happened in the Clinton administration. You had somebody named Johnny Chung who opened a restaurant across the street from the Arkansas State House and somehow inveigled his way, after Clinton became president, to a position of importance within the Clinton White House, who also had ties with Chinese intelligence. And then there was another person who is a Chinese Indonesian who is the head of the Lippo Group, LIPPO, an enormous Indonesian conglomerate, which, like many other Southeast Asian big businesses, is controlled by ethnic Chinese. And he also had good contacts with the Clintons and managed to funnel a great deal of money into their election campaign. And then, let's see, I'm thinking out loud here. There was Wang Jun, who was the head of Baoli, known in the United States as Poly, a big arms dealer in China, who was entertained at coffee at the Clinton White House. And thank goodness I never heard these stories about George Bush or Barack Obama, but it is a bipartisan political game, and there seems to be, as P.T. Barnum is reputed to have said, a sucker born every day, and I think that's what we have here.
So just in the last couple of minutes then, how do you see this situation being dealt with realistically? I mean, my understanding is that when Trump canceled the TPP, he took away a considerable amount of leverage on China, where the whole neighborhood gets organized against you unless you play by the rules. It does seem on the surface that ever since TPP went away, that Xi Jinping has gotten bolder and bolder, and reforms have been turned back, and the whole trajectory towards reform seems to have been reversed. Is there a connection there?
I think it's been exaggerated. Trump did take the country out of the TPP, but he is willing to negotiate back. He just wanted a better deal for the United States. And I think eventually, hopefully, things will come around. And meanwhile, as you said, China is attempting to make the most of this through an alternate program called RCEP, and that's the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership Plan. And this allows countries to play by much looser rules. The Chinese have never been fond of transparency in anything. And so there is little incentive for transparency in the RCEP. And so things, there never is a neat end point in these games, and it's really hard to predict what's going on. But apparently soybean manufacturers are selling, American soybean manufacturers are still selling plenty of soybeans, and it's the Chinese economy that's hurting at the moment.
Well, we will see, and we've run out of time, and we didn't even time to talk about Huawei and 5G. So,
we had so much else to talk about.
Exactly. Let's save that for another conversation, and I thank you very much for joining us here today, June Dreyer.
You're most welcome. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And again, I've been speaking with June Dreyer, who's a professor of political science at the University of Miami, specializing in international relations, Asian-Pacific political and economic systems, Chinese government and foreign policy, and U.S. defense policy. And she was an advisor to the Chief of Naval Operations and is the author of China's Political System, Modernization and Tradition. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into how white nationalist terrorists are seen as deranged loners, whereas Muslims are painted with a broader cultural brush used to indict entire groups of people.
It's a waste of time, because ain't no amount of dancing finna break the bond. Did we go to war and transcend space and time? When every record ain't a record, just a shape behind. You know the stakes is high, we in the face of drama. That's why we can't shake it or escape the problem. It's like a game of roulette, the barrel revolving. They only want to see us occupying a coffin. Mothers crying too often from their lost child even. I'm trying to get over, get under, get even. Get inside, get into, getting dumb, getting greedy. We got to get it right, it's not about to be easy. Come on,
welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Patrick Blanchfield, who's a journalist and faculty member at the Brooklyn Institute for Social Research. His writing on gun violence, mass shootings, and the politics of gun control have appeared in the New York Times, The Nation, Foreign Policy, Book Forum, and Dissent. And his book, Gun Power, The System of American Violence, will appear from Verso Books later this year. Welcome to Background Briefing, Patrick Blanchfield.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
So, Patrick, obviously there's very little to no debate here in Congress and in general about, there may be some debates about gun control, but there's no political action. And it is in stark contrast to what's happening in New Zealand, where the government is moving very quickly to assess the situation vis-a-vis their gun laws, which surprised many people that they were as lax as they were in terms of being able to purchase assault rifles, etc., which the Australian shooter used in this massacre last Friday. So from somebody that deals with the issue here in the United States of gun control versus the NRA, how does the New Zealand situation strike you?
It's certainly striking just in and of its own terms, right? The rapidity with which the government is able to announce, with apparently largely bipartisan consensus, or rather multipartisan consensus, that action is possible. And in that way, it actually resembles fairly recent history in other Commonwealth nations. And here I think specifically of Australia, where in the wake of various mass shootings, legislation and political mobilization happened extremely rapidly and efficaciously. So it's striking in those terms. What I think it also is striking in doing is putting in further sharp relief the ways in which the American situation is fairly unique, even as it is implicated in the situations that are happening in places like New Zealand. And that has both to do with American history and with our current political landscape.
So do you consider the recent move in the courts over the Sandy Hook massacre that took place some time back, where the lawyer for the family have been able to get a gun manufacturer into court?
Yes, I think that could potentially have fairly substantial impacts on the landscape of American gun control. But that's only sort of one particular vector for dealing with the problems of gun violence, right? Manufacturer liability for certain types of weapons will, what may be more dramatic actually will be what will come out in the discovery process as that lawsuit goes forward, actually. But that's a little more up in the air. And I'm happy to talk about that more if you'd like.
Well, it's just that, you know, I don't know whether you recall President Obama at the time when this horrible shooting of these young kids took place and he wasn't able to move for any legislation. He was frustrated to the point of tears. So there was some movement in the new House. They've managed to pass a bill increasing the effectiveness of background checks. But what's the fate of that?
So, I mean, I think that what's going to happen in terms of specific court rulings or even like the background check question, which, you know, the Congress has now endorsed and will probably move forward. There's some point at which if what we're trying to think about is dramatic, rapid change on par with what's happening in New Zealand and what happened in recent decades in Australia, then the issue there is less what's going to play out in any particular bid for legislation or for any particular court outcome than mass mobilization politics and also a connection of gun issues to other social issues in ways that I think our contemporary political bandwidth doesn't accommodate. And that's, again, that sort of network of both roadblocks but also political and social taboos that's present here in the U.S. doesn't map on, I think, to the situation in other in the Commonwealth states like New Zealand. This again gets like to be very granular to your question, right? When we consider things like banning assault weapons or expanding the apparatus of background checks or allocating more resources to the ATF, et cetera, these are measures that in the U.S. context mean dealing with issues of that are very unique about American law enforcement. Right. And about the way in which a great deal of what the broader problem of gun violence is also includes violence by armed law enforcement. It also requires dealing with, and this is another way in which the U.S. is very different from New Zealand or Australia, the very powerful role of arms manufacturers as bipartisan supporters of the American political sort of elite. And so those are both factors that, while I could see us doing certain types of regulatory change, are issues that really need to be front and center in the politics of gun control debates. And I don't think that they necessarily are in the way they should be currently.
And again, I'm speaking with Patrick Blanchfield, who's a journalist and faculty member at the Brooklyn Institute for Social Research. His writing on gun violence, mass shootings, and the politics of gun control have appeared in the New York Times, The Nation, Foreign Policy Book Forum, and Dissent. And his book, Gun Power, The System of American Violence, will be out from Verso Books later this year. But the gun manufacturers you mentioned, they're a powerful lobby and they have a lot of bipartisan influence because they essentially fund the National Rifle Association when they're not being funded by Russian dark money. So they are the ones, when you talk about the ability of the ATF, for example, to do anything about gun control, they have been sabotaged at every turn by legislation pushed by the NRA. The most insane piece of legislation being that people on the terrorist no-fly list, and I think there's only about 800 or 600 on that list, and I think most of them are people that you probably should be watching closely. If they're not allowed to get on an airplane, why in God's name are they allowed to buy an assault rifle? But that is the law of the land.
So there are two. I hear you, and I think there are two elements that are at play in both that example and in the question of the role of gun manufacturers, right? Yes, it is absolutely the case that NRA approval and NRA funds, but also, again, NRA approval is key because NRA ratings get out conservative voters in a way that few other things do, has absolutely thwarted and imposed various bottlenecks upon law enforcement when it comes to dealing with gun, certain types of gun crime, right? The ATF headquarters, like a lot of the gun database serial number tracking stuff literally operates off of 3x5 index cards and paper material because of laws restricting how computers can be used in databases. Like, so that's very, very real and true. But by the same token, I think it's we shouldn't underestimate how, and you can see this present in statements by members of the Democratic primary sort of slate at this point, that they acknowledge that assault rifles may be very bad, but that they are quote unquote weapons of war, which have a fundamental purpose, namely killing American enemies, and thus the people who make them are, on the one hand, yes, they make guns, but also they're proud American companies that are part of the American military-industrial complex. And our defense spending has been pretty consistently on the rise, and so too has been our approval of foreign military sales of those weapons, right? There's a very good chance that the assault rifle used in New Zealand came from the U.S. And so there is some point at which a lot of, I think, the Democratic politics specifically function in this very in this space of a cognitive dissonance or a double bind where it's like, we don't want these guns on our streets. However, they are also important sources of income because we are the world's largest exporter of firearms. And they're also tools for the American security state. And that also gets into the question of the no-fly, no-buy list. Because, yes, you're right, the no-fly list comes up frequently. But so, too, come up terrorist watch lists. And there have been times where I think it was in the wake of Charleston and in 2016, Democratic leadership has proposed expanding, blocking gun purchases by people who are not necessarily on the terrorist no-fly list, but who are on the terrorist watch list, which is hundreds of thousands of people, and includes many people who, you know, are hardly terrorists or are clear and present danger. And so at the point at which we're talking about expanding an apparatus of police control and surveillance that's wedded into, you know, the imperial war machine, a lot of Democrats are all about that. And so I think that the conversation has to be able to deal with that other set of complicities and investments in order for it to be, at least in good faith, if not efficacious.
So let's turn to some of the research you've been doing, Patrick Blanchfield, in terms of the discrepancies on how mass shootings are covered by the media, particularly the U.S. media, where the white perpetrators are basically dismissed as a lone, deranged individual, whereas if it's a Muslim or anybody associated with Islamic terrorism, they're painted with a broader cultural brush.
Yes. Yeah, and I think that this is one of those things that you can perceive even now in these moments, and particularly now in these moments where the details of what actually happened in the shooting are still emerging, right? People, from politicians to media to everyday folks, bring to bear a whole assembly of interpretive frames to very quickly metabolize and make sense of traumatic events as they happen in real time. And you can see this in the way, just very visibly, that the headlines and newspaper front pages cover these stories, right? And I'm thinking here specifically in this example of some of the Murdoch-owned properties in Australia and New Zealand, which have led with the story of how a young man who was so nice became bullied and then somehow did this, right? And there is a clear cultural logic, and this I mean here, there's a clear imperative of basically global white supremacy to when right-wing political actors commit clearly political acts of political violence for explicit political reasons, that is depoliticized and described instead in terms of an individual story of mental illness or personal tragedy or one wayward soul. So it's individualized and pathologized, whereas whenever there is an act of very similar terror committed by someone who is taken to be Muslim or another minority, that they then become, their acts then become purely symptoms of a culture that is pathologized, right? And so in the wake of the Pulse shooting in Florida, for example, the shooter there, is his personal psychology, which is actually quite relevant, was sort of effaced in talking about the issues that that Islamist terror represented. And I think there are a variety of reasons for this and why this happens. One of the most important takeaways, I think, is that we don't want to talk, or people, there's a real imperative to not talk about how the culture that produces that former set of shooters, namely white men, is itself probably pathological. And I'm not endorsing the other culture as pathological. I'm saying we should talk more about the way in which maybe we should pathologize American white supremacy a little bit more. But also, and this is something that I want to allude to the work of the historian Kathleen Ballou in relation to, the past several decades since the war in Vietnam have seen the incredibly sophisticated and violent activity of a transnational white power movement coordinated from and situated within the U.S. and with abundant ties to the American military. A lot of veterans are involved in this. And that's a mode of terrorism that operates with the model of leaderless resistance and lone wolf attacks being a central organizing tentpole. And so part of the way that violence happens and part of what that violence counts on is precisely on this mechanism of erasure and individualization, right? So this is far from the first, or nor will it be the last time in which a white power activist does something and we instead hear about their childhood rather than about the ideology of white power.
Well, apparently the Huffington Post have verified the identities of seven men that are currently serving in the armed forces, yeah, who have posted message on a white supremacy, white nationalist group platform in Europe called Identity Europa.
Yes.
And two are Marines, two are Army ROTC cadets, one's an Army physician and a member of the Texas National Guard, and one's a member of the Air Force. So that's obviously, given how many people in the armed forces, that's not a lot of people, but there may be more, obviously.
We can even go back last month, right, where a Coast Guard officer was arrested with a small cache of assault rifles and other weapons and a kill list of people, including the members of the Democratic opposition and the liberal media, right? And I think what's really important to underscore here is to, and this is what Kathleen Ballou's, I really do, her book is called Bring the War Home. And I strongly recommend it to your listeners as a history of radical white power activism and terrorism that's basically happened since the 70s. And that includes the militia movement stuff and Timothy McVeigh's bombing of the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building in Oklahoma and such like. But one of the consistent features of that history has been a real bleed through with the American military apparatus. And I don't mean that just in some sort of elaborate conspiratorial sense, though you can find a lot of that there, too. Like, there's a kind of revolving door, particularly in the 80s, between right-wing paramilitaries and domestically in the U.S. and people who go abroad to Latin America and to parts of Africa to work as mercenaries, oftentimes with CIA connections. It sounds outlandish, but it's entirely true, and that's something people should look into. But I think that the affinity may be a little bit deeper in that, right? Within the context of the war on terror specifically, we spent two decades globally basically waging a war on Muslims and fetishizing snipers and individual operators and people who carry assault rifles for a living. And I'm not trying to be naive. I'm not trying to naively postulate direct causality, but I think there is something profound going on between the idea that the world is a battlefield and that we're in a state of endless war against people who just so happen to have a particular set of beliefs and pigmentation, and the fact that anywhere within American or other, you know, Commonwealth civilian space, those same people can be massacred by people toting rifles and espousing ideology that sounds a lot like neoconservative or even bipartisan liberal ideology when it comes to the war on terror. I think that's organic and real. And I think the general militarization of our culture has produced this.
Well, I think one of the factors that militarizes our culture are these video games, because what video games by and large are about the user being faced with an endless wall of encroaching evil, terrorism, whatever, monsters, whatever, and you've just got to keep shooting them and shooting them and shooting them. And that's the idea that I think has somehow been borrowed by these white supremacists, is the white people are the minority and they have to stand up against these hordes of colored people advancing on them like zombies.
Yeah, I hear you there too. Like, it is, you know, it always gets very difficult to talk about like direct psychological causation between the consumption of certain media and violent action. And clearly people can consume these media all the time. I do myself, and they don't step out and do these things. And there are entire countries where, you know, for example, Japan and South Korea, they play a lot more video games and a lot of super violent video games than do Americans. And yet they don't have this problem. So clearly there are other issues at play here too. But I think you are specifically right about particularly the packaging of this latest episode, but also the idea of just the individual warfighter as like this fetish object for American culture, particularly in a period in which American culture and quote unquote the West is under siege by, as you correctly point out, these sort of fungible hordes of others who just need to be mowed down, according to this logic. And that ramifies, you know, both in video games, but also when I would give him much more power than any video game, you know, the mouths of our president talking about war crimes against Muslims during the Philippine insurrection, right? What I'm saying is that we have an abundance of emblematic symptoms of a profoundly militarized and racist culture. And we also have people who enforce and produce that racist and militarized culture through acts of violence like this and through enabling at the highest levels of power. And that's a pretty bad scene.
Well, Patrick Blanchfield, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Pleasure. It was really good to talk to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Patrick Blanchfield, who's a journalist and faculty member at the Brooklyn Institute for Social Research. His writing on gun violence, mass shootings, and the politics of gun control have appeared in the New York Times, The Nation, Foreign Policy, Book Forum, and Dissent. And his book, Gun Power, The System of American Violence, will be out from Verso Books later this year. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available at backgroundbriefing.org, where we have just made it easier for you to sign up for email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcast. If you like this program, we encourage you to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, and SoundCloud. And please do share today's program with friends, family, and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. We've also made it easier for you to help us sustain our mission, spread the word, and keep us corporate and commercial free by adding a donation button. So if you are in a position to give support, please take a moment and visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to make America think again. Bye for now.